Yo, what's up, people? Welcome to my podcast. It is The Solar Kid, and this is The Other Side of the Sun. Today, I have Junior Tomlin, who is a illustrator, designer. Yeah? Am I correct? Artist?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
I'm going to be talking to him about his art, about his latest book, artwork that's, volume of 35 years of artwork that's just coming
out. Yes. 30 years of artwork doing record covers and rave flyers for the rave movement.
Yeah, and that's such a sick concept, man. I mean, like, flyers, you know, the rave movement. I can't believe it's 30 years of the rave movement.
Yes. Because I started in 1989.
So that's literally like probably the birth of the rave movement then, yeah?
You can say that that's when the music changed. It was changing from then.
Okay. Yeah?
Because the first record cover that I did there was for Renegade Soundwave. I don't know if you remember them.
So I'm from South Africa, yeah? So like a lot of my knowledge would probably only come from like, say, the early 2000s, obviously regarding my age, and also maybe the exposure that we had to, you know, the stuff from over here. I mean, like, I'm not going to lie, like, when I was growing up, a lot of, like, UK artists that I saw on TV and radio or heard on radio, I thought they were American. Soul to Soul, Sade, you know. Yeah, I just didn't know any better, really. Well, I did, personally, so.
Yeah. In those days, there was so much homegrown talent.
I've come to know. I mean, I've been here now over 15 years, and I've come to learn so much about, like, you know, the culture over here, and like especially in terms of like black music, and like even in terms of like grime and rave and everything. I mean, drum. I mean, I used to love drum and bass and like garage and two step and stuff back home, but like actually coming and being immersed in the culture and learning about it has been a really eye opening experience for me. So yeah, tell us a little bit about you know, what you do and a bit of your background.
Well, a bit of my background is that I was born and raised in Ladbroke Grove.
Yeah, West London.
Yeah, good old West London. Mm. Never moved out. Yeah, lived there all my life. Yeah, the only time that I did move out is when I lived in the Hall of Residence up in Camberwell for about 2.5 years.
And you must have just wanted to come straight back, I'm sure.
Well, I finished my tour of duty going to college up there.
Okay.
The journey was just a little bit mad. You're talking about an hour just to get there. Mm-hmm. And in that hour, your enthusiasm just dies.
Yeah.
So I just decided I'd rather live closer to the college than travel, two hours a day.
What's that? That's south, isn't it? Camberwell.
Yeah. Lewisham Way.
Lewisham, yeah.
We've got this college now. I did a graphic design course. Yeah. 3-year graphic design course. That would have led me to be a graphic designer, but I couldn't get a job as one. So I changed the entire portfolio to illustration.
Okay. When was that? Like, what year was that?
It was 1983, 84.
Yeah, it's probably just the wrong time then, isn't it? Because, I mean, they're so in demand nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah. So, my first illustration jobs was doing computer game packaging artwork.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
We're talking about 8-bit games.
Yeah. Yeah. Atari ST.
Oh, wow. Okay, so we go in.
Amiga 500.
Okay.
So I used to do a lot of the packaging artwork for that.
So that was like a square box with the packaging and like the leaflet inside and that kind of thing.
Yeah, because sometimes the box is very small, as you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes the box was actually bigger, and you'll have a poster inside, which is basically like either an A4 poster
Of course. So you could have like characters and stuff. So you'd have sometimes you'd have a character in there that you could put on your wall or something as well.
Yeah, or a nice poster.
Okay.
So
was that for an actual company or like?
So, yes, that was for various companies.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've done, like, you know, quite a few. I work for a company called Logotron Entertainment. Yeah, I work for a company called, like, CRL, Computers Rental Limited, that was bought up by, I think that was bought up by Virgin.
Okay.
Because I've done two covers for them. Then they was bought up, and then they had to basically, like, see if they was going to release again. So they bought the covers off me yet again.
Okay, so, I see. Nice. Were there many people like yourself doing that kind of thing?
There was a few. There was two other black artists who used to do airbrushing. Okay. That's why I used to use an airbrush. And I don't know what happened to them. Yeah. The years happened, and then, you know, you get further and further apart, and then before you know, you just don't hear from them, and you can't even find them on the internet. Like, they've got no presence whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah, because that style, like, I mean, like, even that's one of your pieces in the background, right?
Yep, it certainly is.
So, like, that style seems like airbrushed. It looks really, like, clean and sleek, you know? I remember, because there was a guy in Johannesburg who started, like, airbrushing, you know, like, graffiti art and tagging. So there was a guy who actually started airbrushing, and all of a sudden, graffiti just started looking, like, nice and clean and really, like, artistic. I mean, that's really cool style.
The one behind me, that's Vector Graphics.
Vector Graphics.
Yeah. Like, are you familiar with a program called Adobe Illustrator?
I wouldn't say I know how to use it, but I know what it is. One of my friends is an illustrator or designer as well. So he's told me a bit about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do most of my artwork with Illustrator because it's Vector Graphics and it can basically be scaled up any size without losing quality.
Okay.
So I prefer that than using, say, Photoshop.
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that word because recently I've been, like, getting people to do some artwork for me. And my friend, who is a designer as well, he said, make sure you get all the vector files. And now he's actually clicking what it means. So basically, getting the file so that it can be scaled into any size.
Yeah. Yes. Because if you're doing it in, say, let's say Photoshop, and you wanted it to be, like, you know, as big as the one behind me, you know that file size will be quite big.
Okay, and it's not going to be pixelated, or it's not going to look
like, exactly.
Yeah,
because vector files don't pixelate.
Okay. Yeah. But I assume only people like yourself know how to use them. You can only open them up in, like, a program like Illustrator, isn't it? Or...
That's not entirely true, because what happens is that you can save out your file as a PDF.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you can open it in, like, you know, Acrobat Reader or any program that you can open a PDF in. Yeah, you can open up an Illustrator file, provided it's saved as a PDF.
Okay, but then can you still resize that PDF as well?
Yes, you can.
Okay, without losing any quality as well?
Without losing any quality, because the lovely thing is that you can create it the size behind it, or you can basically create it smaller, but tell the printer that you want the output to be bigger.
Okay. You see, I'm on a learning lesson today, man. I'm going to be learning about illustration and graphics from you today.
Yeah. I used to teach Illustrator as well, and I still do.
Okay. Wow. So I've read that you've been called the Salvador Dali of the rave scene.
Yes, the Salvador Dali of rave.
I do love Salvador Dali. I mean, I don't claim to know everything about him, but I've always liked looking at his artwork. So what does that mean, like, the Salvador Dali of the rave scene? Is that because of your work?
Yeah, it's because of the surrealist content of my work.
Mm-hmm.
Because my work now is like a mashup of, like, Afrofuturism, surrealism, yeah, and sci-fi and fantasy, all that mashed up together.
I like it. I actually like that word. I was going to ask you about that, Afrofuturism. Like, that is that a big part of your creativity? And like, what does that, is that just like Afro sci-fi or drawing from the part of, like, yeah?
Yes, it's like Afro sci-fi. It's basically like the depiction of like black people in the futuristic, you know, narrative.
So like Wakanda.
Exactly. Because when you sort of like look at what, you know, Black Panther, you're basically saying, yeah, that is like the epitome of Afrofuturism.
With all like the vibranium and, you know, all the powers and the technology. And,
it's like if the African continent was left alone and the black people, like, you know, started to advance with the technology, they will be in like that higher state that they're in now. But because they're being like colonized, they can't basically like create their own little utopia.
Yeah.
Because they're always in debt to someone else.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's the history of that colonization as well, because when they left, they still basically kept the hold over, you know, the countries that they were in.
Yeah.
And then created
it's basically like they left, they locked the door, but kept the keys.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly that. And then basically they gave one key to maybe like the political leader, or like half a key to one of the political leaders, so that they can live okay or whatever. And then the majority of the country are just like, you know, trying to fight for scraps.
Yeah. And then when you don't know it, they probably sort of like make another copy of the key and then sell it to someone else.
Yeah, probably China or something.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think the Chinese probably made their own keys, man, and now they're coming in.
No, what they probably the Chinese did do is that they bought the lock.
Ah. And then sell like the bits of basically. I've noticed that all over South Africa and in Africa, like the Chinese presence has like it's increased like dramatically in the last 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, the good thing is that they are providing infrastructure for the locals and stuff, but then also I can see that they're starting to encroach on like taking, how can I say, profit from the economy, like, you know what I mean? I wouldn't say stealing, because they are selling and they are creating business, but it's interesting what's happening.
But it's because it's just another foothold. Because if you can't get your minerals, your gold, your precious metals out of your own country, and you've got a vast continent like Africa, which is still untapped, why not go over there?
You go
over there, you do deals where you know that the people are so hell-bent getting their hands on like more money. So you basically got them half in your pocket already because they're greedy.
That's just what the politicians are doing. They're selling away the country for, you know, disposable income.
Yeah, because one day an African man will be born and he's gonna wake up, look out his window, but really he's woke up in Africa. You know, no, he's woken up in China.
Woken up in China. I've seen like people are even learning Mandarin and stuff like that in South Africa now.
Africa for the African.
Yeah, I mean that's the premise. And the thing is, like, for me, it's weird because even before I left South Africa, I was very involved in like black consciousness and black consciousness movement and Steve Biko, Garvey, and Pan-Africanism. I was a poet and I used to perform like poetry and stuff. But it's actually more since I've come here that I've understood how big the scale of this thing is, and like how, not helpless, but like, I mean, I feel like people in the diaspora in England and in the States and stuff like do a lot in terms of like trying to provide for the country. But the people in the country are not seeing above this threshold, you know what I mean? A lot of them don't realize that there is this bigger picture, you know?
Yeah, they fail to see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Because it's like they're worried about their everyday living
rather than
thinking about what their children know what their grandchildren and their children's children is going to eat or what the state of the country is.
I suppose, I mean, it's, you can't blame it. I mean, if people are like, I mean,
you can't blame them. But there should be like things like put in place here. It's like if any foreign power comes to your country, yeah, you have to put in certain things in place here where you're not selling your land because you can't get land back. After you sold the land, guess what? It's someone else's.
Mm, yeah.
So selling your land is like selling parts of your country.
Yeah. I mean, it's like me selling parts of my body. I mean, like literally. Yeah. And yeah. I see billboards recently, like in the past few years. Like, just I go on the train and I see like these billboards, buy land in Africa.
Yeah, a nice one when you said, yeah, it's like you selling parts of your body. It's like, put it this way. Can you imagine if you sell both your hands?
And then someone else has to feed you, isn't it?
Yes.
You're sitting there and you're going to basically have to come and take, you know, wait for the next person.
And by the time, and when you want to use your hands, there's a surcharge. And that's how they get you.
Sometimes frustrating talking about these things, you know, but I do feel positivity in the sense that many people are waking up and like a lot of us and a lot of people in Africa and around the world are starting to understand what needs to be done and how to like kind of, you know, mobilize yourself, especially the younger people of today that have the internet. You can see, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, we didn't have internet or anything. I'm sure obviously the same for you. But now I'm noticing this generation of between 16 to 22, they seem switched on, man. And also like the global culture is much more united in a sense, you know? So I think a lot of people are starting to realize this. And I'm hoping that in future, like with people like myself, with people from the diaspora, taking things home or spreading and like helping and sharing information and knowledge and tools and skills that it will eventually get to that stage, you know?
Yeah, because all it is like one country at a time.
Yeah.
Once you've got like a stable infrastructure, a stable country where there's going to be no war, no famine, and it basically works just fine because you've got a model, you go to another African country and say, we've got this model that works. Are you interested?
Mm.
Yeah. And that's how you can basically unite the different states in Africa to think in the same way.
In principle, I'd say, yeah. But then you must remember, it's not even long ago that we had these xenophobic attacks in South Africa. Like, people within South Africa attacking Zimbabweans or people from outside of South Africa. Literally because of, I'd say, ignorance, you know what I mean, to a large extent.
Yeah, because that's the, you know, a legacy of, like, colonialism.
Apartheid, yeah.
Yeah, because once you put a border anywhere, you're trying to say those people are better than these people are better than that people, and that is where you get your conflict. Mm. Rather than they're not seeing the whole picture that if this is Africa, you're all in it, you're all Africans.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter about the lines.
Yeah.
You know, even though that person might speak a different dialect to you, guess what? You can both learn each other's dialect, so then you can have more of a future dialogue.
Mm. Yeah, we have to just keep the conversation going, man. Like, you know what I mean? Literally. But I think we just slightly went off. I just wanted to talk about, a bit more about the Salvador Dali thing, man. Like, I just want to talk a bit more about the Salvador Dali.
Yeah, but the Salvador Dali thing, it came about when I was I went to the offices of Kicking Records.
Okay.
And that is the company that I used to do a lot of record covers for.
Kicking Records.
Yeah. Yeah. And they used to have like fan mail. People used to send the manager letters saying, oh, yeah, I really like this track, this, that, and other. So there was one particular day where I went in and Peter Harris, the guy who used to own Kicking Records, he showed me this letter. And at the bottom of the letter, it says, tell Junior Tomlin, he is the Salvador Dali of rave.
Sick.
That was from me doing record covers. But it then later got it translated into like doing like rave life. And they sort of like, kept that name ever since. You know?
I mean, record covers and even like posters for events and stuff is such an important part of the music itself, you know? Like, I mean, yeah. I mean, maybe not. I mean, I suppose it still is now, but I mean, more so when you could actually buy a physical, you know, piece of artwork where you'd like, whether it was a record or cassette or whatever, and you take out the sleeve and there's like, you know, bits inside and you can actually look at it, stuff like that. That's really was such an important part of, I mean, still is
it. Yeah, because it was so much better then, yeah, because people were releasing their albums and 12-inch singles that people need artwork for.
Ah.
So your artwork is seen in the 12x12 format.
Mm.
And then sometimes, yeah, that format is like, you know, changed to cassette form. And you know how big a cassette is.
Yeah.
But this album that you created, which is this big, gets done squared down into that size. And then even worse, yeah, down into a cassette size. So it just gets smaller and smaller. But it's quite interesting. So, you know, you can put in a level of detail in it, but when it gets scaled down into like a cassette, yeah, a lot of the detail is lost and it's just an image.
Ah, I see.
But it was fun doing it. Because
I don't do any, like, do you still do any now?
Yes.
You're still creating artwork for?
Yeah.
Is it only specifically Rave or anything else?
Whoa, yeah, it's Happy Hardcore.
Happy Hardcore.
Yeah.
You DJ?
No, I don't DJ. I like music, but I really like to DJ at one point. I was on a internet radio show where I was basically the digital DJ.
Okay.
I was basically like typing what I needed to say.
So digital plus, selector.
Yeah, plus selecting the music, talking about it, and sharing with them the music that I've selected. So they could basically find it on YouTube.
So when you say like hardcore rave, like what is that? Like proper progressive? Or what kind of hardcore rave? Like proper dance music? Like?
It's like old school. Have you ever heard the term old school rave?
I've heard old school rave, but what kind of falls into that category? Like, do you have any?
It's like more electronic. It's not jungle. It's not drum and bass. Yeah, it's just happy hardcore.
Happy hardcore.
You know, hard, fast, repetitive beats.
Okay. That's your thing. I mean, so. So does that mean that you had an experience with a lot of psychedelics back then, or? Because I know that music is synonymous with that kind of thing.
Yeah, psychotropic drugs and things like that. Mm. Well, I went to a few raves and I had an interesting experience where I was showing somebody my artwork and they asked me a question. They said, do you take drugs? And I said, no. And they said, why not? And another good one, yeah, was somebody looked at my pictures in the art gallery, and they said, "Yeah, that." They said to me, "I would like to have what you're on."
So, is it safe to say you've never done that kind of stuff, or you're not indulging?
No, I need a clear head to do artwork.
Okay. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I relate to that. So you've never been like, oh, I need to get high, I need to do this, and like self-loathing, and you know, some of these serious artists like get into these states to kind of inspire creative stuff like that.
No. Yeah, I'm not like some of those old, like you said, sci-fi writers who need to be in a drug-induced like mental state in order for them to write.
Yeah,
it has to come purely from the head.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting because, I mean, like you said, that person asked you, well, I want to have what you on. because some of your artwork does look like that. I mean, it looks like, you know, this guy was probably in some, you know, deep, like some heavy tripped out state, man.
See, the other thing about also creating artwork here is that what you also believe can translate itself into little pieces into your artwork. So you can look in my art and you could find little iconography in there that you could relate to. Not all of it has got it.
In terms of like what, you believe in terms of like spirituality or
say spirituality, like, you know, and things like dolphins and wildlife and things like that, and say Mother Nature, it's all contained in the artwork in some shape or form, depending on what the brief is.
Okay. So do you only work specifically to brief, or do you like just get creative? You know what I mean?
I like to get creative. A lot of the time when I'm doing like record covers, it's basically like they just tell me the name of the track.
And then it's like, just go wild.
Yeah. And sometimes the name of the track basically denotes what the image is going to be.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
some of the rave flyers is nearly the similar thing. But there are, you know, rave organizers who basically tell you, yeah, I want A, B, and C on the flyer. And it doesn't really make for a great piece of art sometimes, because the idea does not gel. Mm. There's one particular one here, it was called The Pineapple Is On One.
Well, when you say that, I think of a pineapple with headphones having a drink or looking really like...
Yeah. So this is how the guy described the cover that he wanted. He wanted a man and a woman standing up, yeah, next to an open doorway, pointing towards the doorway, and in the doorway, you could see a pumpkin. So it was like a Halloween type rave.
Okay, I see. Okay.
So, in other words, it's like somebody draws you a picture, and all you do is like basically fill it in. There's no creativity in that. You know, rather than leaving me to do my thing, they basically like painted the picture that you basically have to adhere to. Then you like painting by numbers.
No, but I can completely relate to that, because I mean, sometimes if I'm doing a mix for someone and then people like, I mean, like when you're listening to music or when you're listening to like a mix, it's so subjective sometimes, you know what I mean? Because sometimes I hear things slightly differently to how you hear it. So they'll be like, I want this to be warmer. I want this to sound a bit more blue, for argument's sake. I'm like, what? What do you want me to do? Like,
you know what I mean? They're talking in a totally different language. Yeah. And it's like, oh yeah, I want it to be warmer. Oh yes, I can put some red in it.
But that could be red, it could be orange, it could be yellow, it could be what? Like somewhere.
Yeah. I want you to do a sound that sounds hot.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. Oh man.
So your brain is baffled here by someone else's idea of what you do. So the point here where it basically throws you off a bit because you're trying to work out their way of thinking.
I think that's a lot of it, like especially even in my field, is like trying to, how can I say, appease people's understanding of thoughts of how they want to perceive the music. And I feel like a lot of the time it's like I use confidence to convey my ideas, you know, rather than the actual product, because like I feel sometimes you sort of subliminally program people to believe that that is what they want, because otherwise they can keep asking for changes and saying no, that's not the right way, especially if you try and be too technical and explain things in your lingo.
But it's easy when someone says, yeah, I want it to be more ethereal.
Like,
like that, you can nearly hear that, you know, the angels singing. That sound.
Yeah, no, I get a lot about that, man. Oh my goodness. Do you do any music? Do you play any? I remember on the Zoom podcast we were doing for the Commit and Us, you were playing some djembe and stuff there as well. Do you get involved?
Yeah, I play djembe. Play, you know, bongos. I play a bit of, like, you know, percussion.
Okay, so what, do you go and jam with the guys at the village and that? Or?
I haven't jammed with them for flipping ages, really. There was about 2 months ago, last month, yeah, we'd done, like, something for the Grenfell...
Remembrance.
Remembrance. We drummed for about 20 minutes at Paris Square, And then we went down to the Wall of Truth. Mm-hmm. And then with like 9 other drummers, we drummed for an hour.
Okay. Was that with...
Yeah, that was with Niles and...
Niles and him. Okay, yeah. Because I was just going to say, yeah. Grandpa and those guys.
Yeah, and then sometimes, yeah, because if you remember like last year and the year before, every Sunday they used to have like a little gathering of drummers.
Yes, yeah.
In Portobello Road.
Yeah.
And sometimes I used to join them.
Okay. So do you know a guy called Dembis Tong? He's from West Africa. He's West African. He leads the African drumming. He also goes there to the village sometimes. He's usually there a lot, actually. He teaches Dembis.
Oh, Dembi.
Yeah, Dembi. Dembi.
Yes, I know him. He reskinned my drum and he done an awesome job.
Yes.
Yeah. I have to go back to the village to get my drum tightened, so to speak.
Yeah, I need to get mine, actually. I played with him. I actually played bass with him for a gig at Hootenanny last year as well. So I was rehearsing with him for a while. Yeah. So I used to go and jam there a lot, but like because I live a bit further now, it's just harder for me to get down to Ladbroke Grove and West London, you know. I've got kids as well and stuff, so it's a bit harder to get down there all the time.
Yeah.
But I do try sometimes when I have some free time just to go and jam with the guys and, you know. What's your take on the whole, because I drive a lot and obviously I've been locked down, so I haven't been out much, but. What's your take on the lockdown so far and what's your experience been like?
My experience hasn't been too bad, but the whole lot of thing with like COVID and the deaths, some things don't make sense.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, you can't really put your hand on it, your finger on it yet, but things don't make sense. And the information that the government tell you sounds not right.
Mm.
They're giving people, they're making people more confused. Mm. Yeah. And it's like every month it goes on, the more confusing that things get. It does not add up.
I think what you said first is literally how I feel. It's like there's something that you just can't put your finger on. Like I can't understand. It just doesn't make sense to me, all of this. I mean, I see there's people dying and I know that people have been affected. But I don't know. It's just something I can't put my finger on. I can't explain what it is. It just doesn't feel right.
The more you can't put your finger on it, the more you're thinking of like, say, the conspiracy theories.
Mm.
That makes it even worse because your mind will start to run rampant with all what you know, all what you hear, plus personal history and the history of the peoples. Then you're thinking it can only go down that way. And now they're calling everybody of the ethnic origin like bait.
That is such a weird one that they came out with this whole only people of like the high risk people of ethnic origins are all high risk.
If you take a look at the name BAME,
it's a Black Asian and what am I not, what does it stand for, BAME?
Oh, something minority.
Or ethnic. Yeah.
So if you take those letters and you add an L, you get blame. So it's nearly like they're blaming us, you know?
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I mean, like you were saying, even about the conspiracy theories, like it's so easy. Like when it started in March, I think I spent a few weeks just going in on all these conspiracies and everything on my brain, just going mad. I was watching David Icke. I don't know if you know, if you've seen much of
David Icke.
There's this guy called Farrow from the States who was going in on the government as well. He expounds all these conspiracy theories. And then after like 2-3 months, I was just like, nah, enough of this. I can't.
But the more you think about conspiracy, then when you say that if there's no conspiracy, it just means that the government is totally incompetent.
Mm.
And the government would wear that badge with honor, the incompetence banner.
Yeah, it's really it's sad, man.
Yeah. Sad. And then now you're also thinking, in the terms of the year where you've got a pandemic, but certain countries are, what's that word, weaponizing the pandemic. Basically get rid of a whole of their population.
That is, it's deep. It's really sad. I mean, I've seen in South Africa how, oh my God, it's really bad. And like the corruption, that how the people have been using the pandemic, the government, you know what I mean? Like, just, oh my word. And like the people have been stressed out, man. Like, you know, do you know in South Africa, they basically, people couldn't buy cigarettes or alcohol for the last like 3 months.
They'll be going mad.
That's what I mean. They've been literally, people have been going crazy. Plus, people live in such close proximity to each other. If you think in townships and those types of places, people have been going mad. You know, I mean, South Africa already has one of the highest rape, you know what I mean? You know, how can I say, like they have the highest rape statistics in the world. You know, like people are probably, like today was the first day that they've actually allowed people to buy cigarettes and alcohol. So can you imagine, like, after all that time, all this building up now, people are probably going to go crazy though, man.
Yeah.
It's like you're holding a bull against a fence for so long and so long, and now you open the fence, and this guy's going to go and just go and...
Yeah, because at the end of it, a whole lot of people will have mental issues because now they're free. Because, like, 3 months of captivity.
Yeah, literally. 3 months
and of now captivity. They're free.
And then this vaccine business as well.
What business as well?
The vaccine that they want to start testing in Africa as well. Because of why the same...
Why are they testing it in Africa, of all places?
I don't know. Apparently, it's part of the same reason of this. I don't know. I don't know if it's the resistance. I don't want to be misquoted or like give the wrong information, but there's something to do with, I don't know, the resistance of Africans and the fact that they can work out faster, like because of the genetics of African people, they can work out quicker how it reacts or, you know, something like that. I mean, I'm being very vague in that description. But
but it still sounds like blame to me.
Oh, literally. Let's move a bit away from the COVID thing. Tell us a bit about you've been credited as working with like Marvel and DC Comics and, you know, those kind of things. That's pretty cool, man. I mean, I love comics as well.
Yeah, because it's Marvel Comics is, you know, fun to work with, because I was doing digital coloring for Spider-Man, Action Man, Fantastic Four.
Wow.
Yeah, I even Transformers Armada.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's this comic that I worked in for, you know, Marvel Panini for years. It was called like Action Man, the greatest hero.
I've heard of Action Man. Yeah.
I used to work on that. It was a great gig at the time. It was a very good gig.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Yeah. I also worked for Titan on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh wow! Was that when it first came out, like in the 90s or?
No, in the 2000s.
2000, was it? Yeah. When did they come out? They came out. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've worked on that, and I also worked for 2000 AD.
Okay.
You know, the English comic.
Yeah. I've heard of 2000 AD. I mean, like, I'm not. Like, how can I say? I never collected comics to like a high, like, I mean, I kind of delved up into music more at a later age. But when I was younger, I used to read loads. I still got a few comics here, actually. But I wasn't like a heavy comic geek kind of dude, you know? I used to love my comics, but you get some people that like know the issue. They know, like, they preserve the comics like, in the original form and stuff like that. Like,
yeah. Those are the people, the total geeks.
Yeah, I wasn't that guy though. I mean, I still used to go. I still go. Like, there's a few places in London. What's the place called?
Yeah, the big main one is Forbidden Planet.
Forbidden Planet. Yes. So I have a friend of mine who's the illustrator as well. Whenever he comes over, I always take him there. Or like, he always goes. He wants to go and have a browse, and, you know, because he buys like action figures and, you know, things like
that.
Oh yeah, he's a bit of a geek in that sense. But I do love the culture though. I love the culture. I've always been fascinated by the culture. It's such a cool thing. Do you know much about the new brow art movement?
No, I don't. That sounds interesting.
So I'd say maybe 10 years, 15 years ago, there was this movement to start within like probably LA and that kind of area, and came over here, which basically took traditional art and brought it into the 21st century. And basically, how can I say, they made things like graffiti or like using different mediums or anything within the new kind of way of creating art. They made it like a, to kind of take it up to highbrow art, where people can actually be selling things that are, how can I say, you know, like how you airbrush things, whereas a traditional painter or whatever, or these traditional collectors, or, you know what I mean, gallery owners wouldn't necessarily show like artwork like that.
Yeah.
So there was a gallery in Portobello, just off Portobello Road, called the London Miles Gallery. Yeah, this is about 10, when I used to still live down there. And they used to show a lot of this kind of new brow artwork. So it was like graphic art, graffiti, airbrushing techniques, and like all this like weird stuff. And I mean, I still get like, I get emailed a newsletter from this company, well, this online gallery called ThinkSpace. So ThinkSpace, they still show like a lot of that kind of art. ThinkSpace, thinkspacegallery.com. And there's quite a few artists that I follow there, like Brian Iveras, and
let's check that out.
Stella M. Halkenberg. And like, it's literally this new brow, new wave of art, where it's not the traditional oil on canvas or pastels or blah, 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 and stuff that could be sold. And it's literally the new forms and incorporating all the new digital ways of creating art and print, you know what I mean? That's what I was going to say, like, with the COVID thing, just to go back again, I suppose for us, it didn't affect us as much, because artists and musicians and people like me, we locked down generally all the time anyway.
Yeah, because we live to create and lock ourselves away to create and only come out for food fresh air. Other people start to turn stir crazy because they're out every day.
Yeah, literally. I mean, I've enjoyed, I mean, as bad as it is to say, I've enjoyed the lockdown period. It's given me so much time to finish off so many projects that I've had on hold, you know.
And actually, and now you have to make up new ones.
Yeah. Well, it's given me a better work ethic as well. Like, do you have any like superstitions? Or do you have like a favorite like clothing that you like to wear when you create, or like shoes or something? You know, like
No, I haven't. But I do sometimes like to create to listening to JungleTrain.net.
JungleTrain.net. What's that, a radio station?
It's a online radio station that just play jungle.
Okay. Yeah.
Bass. Yeah. Because as I know, I used to do a lot of record covers for jungle and drum and bass. So, you know, that's also quite interesting. Because the last one interview that I'd done, was for International DJ Magazine.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think that's been edited and come out yet, but that's you know, quite interesting. Yeah. And I'm also in a group, called the Afrocentrics.
Okay, the Afrocentrics. I love Afrocentricism. Yeah. So you know about Afropunk in that, yeah?
Aye?
Afropunk.
I've heard of Afropunk, but I haven't listened to any.
Well, I mean, they're not a band. They're more like a brand that basically support Afrofuturism and anything to do with the movement of Afro-African, culture in a more modern setting. Like, they've had gigs, and like they've hosted gigs all over the world. There's been one in South Africa, there's one in London, Paris, you know, and like people of this whole African new age movement come together to celebrate, you know, I'd say Afrofuturism as well, actually. Afropunk, you need to come up.
Yeah. Because there was this other term, what was it? Daft Punk, another one. I've forgotten, but that's what Afropunk basically nearly sounds like. Retro.
Yeah, I mean, I love like anything my tastes are so broad, it's hard.
That's it. Steampunk.
Steampunk. Okay. Yeah, you'll have to give me all the links for these things when we finish, so I can put it up. I mean, just to kind of close off the conversation, man, like, is there anything that you want to plug or like tell us about, or, you know, like you said?
Yes, I'd like to tell you about my book.
Yes, awesome.
Yes, my book here is a combination of 30 years artwork, doing record covers and ray flyers. Yeah, it's 160 pages.
Wow.
It's hardback.
Hardback.
Yeah, it's a coffee table book, a must have for anybody who loves art and loves a little bit of social commentary with your artwork. Yeah. I started in 1989 doing artwork, and it finishes off to basically the present day. It's published by Velocity Press.
Okay.
Yeah. If you can't find Velocity Press, you can find my website, and it's on there, juniortomlin.com. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and all the usual relevant places. Social media, because that's what you have to do. You have to plug things through social media. Mm-hmm. And it would basically be quite interesting to try to sell a book through lockdown, and you can't even have a release.
Okay. Oh, you mean like a launch?
We couldn't have a launch yet because of all this COVID stuff.
Yeah. Are you planning to do any launch at any point? Because lockdown has kind of
happened, so. Yes, because I would like to do a launch, and I also like to do signings.
Okay.
And basically, talks, to inspire the black youth.
Yes.
People like me who's still out there doing it after 30 years.
Yeah, man. Definitely. I'd love to see that. And when you do, please let me know. But Junior, thank you so much for coming on today, man. I really appreciate it, bro. Honestly, it's been such a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I hope it's not the last. I'll probably get you on again at some point, hopefully when you have your launch or...
can't wait.
Okay, yeah. No, I'll definitely let you know, man. So thank you so much for that. And people, don't forget to subscribe, like, and share this video. It's called The Other Side of the Sun Podcast, and we are Junior Tomlin today. Peace.
Okay. Peace.